I make it 11:15, so pause again. My name is Anne Lindley. I'm an academic at SOAS at the University of London. I work on migration, and recently I've been doing some research around civic engagement with immigration detention, which has brought me into contact with the two organisations that are represented here today. So my job is really just to explain the rationale for this panel and to introduce the speakers. Obviously this morning's theme is countering social exclusion, and detention really is a form of very extreme social exclusion, isolating people from family, friends, from community systems of support and so on. And I'm not going to go over the ground that Trevor Truman has so kindly hinted at. We've already heard a bit about detention in the first session. But just to say, there's a lot of people working to address the issue of detention. So people inside detention are resisting in the ways that they can, and we'll hear a bit about that. And people outside are mobilising to provide individual support and also to try to change the general system. In my research, I've counted some 40 organisations that are working in some substantial way on the issue of immigration and detention, and lots of us that are kind of drawn in through different ways into the issue. And those organisations really range from small groups of volunteers in hospitals, living rooms, through to a well-established national charity. So quite a lot of variety. But you'll probably also be aware that civic engagement around the issue of immigration detention has ramped up significantly in recent years. In 2015 and 2016, there was a major demonstration and direct action inside and outside detention centres across the country. A series of official inquiries and reviews, parliamentary activity on the issue, strategic litigation, which we'll hear about, increased public advocacy by people who've got first-hand experience of being in detention. I've got hard-hitting media exposés, and importantly, efforts to network these organisations around key campaigns. So the reason I propose that detention action and movement for justice that we try and invite them to talk at this conference, and why I'm delighted that they've come, is that they've been at the forefront of these developments and this kind of momentum. They work in different ways, as you'll hear, and with different aims, but they both come up with dynamic and impactful responses to the issue of immigration detention. So we're going to hear from each of them, and then we'll have about half an hour or so for questions and for discussion. So maybe while he's getting ready, I'll introduce Jerome Phelps. Do you want to use the
I'll wander around, yeah.
Okay, you're right. And he's the director of Detention Action, and he's really built up the organisation into a well-established national charity providing support and advice to people held in immigration removal services near Heathrow Airport, as well as campaigning for an end to immigration detention without a time limit and to the practice of detaining people because they came to Ireland. In 2015, Detention Action won the Liberty Human Rights Campaign of the Year Award for their successful legal challenge to shut down the detained fast track. And in his 20 minutes, Jerome is going to talk to us about reforming indefinite detention, the current situation of asylum seekers in detention, and opportunities to reduce the use of detention. So welcome.
Thank you. So 5 years ago, I was invited to give a presentation at a conference of the independent monitoring boards of the detention centres, a presentation on indefinite detention, which we had just started campaigning on a couple of years earlier, alongside someone from the Home Office, from criminal casework, the part of the Home Office that's most responsible for locking people up for years when they can't be deported because they're foreign criminals. So I ended up, the conference was in the countryside somewhere, I forget where, and we ended up getting the train together back. Somewhat awkward, but small talk. We talked about how we saw this issue. My organisation had just commissioned some research on the costs waste of indefinite detention, how much public money is being wasted by locking people up for years and then releasing them anyway. 76 million we found. So I was like, well, seems a little bit inefficient from your point of view, isn't it? I'm struggling to see how this works for the Home Office, for Immigration Control. And he was like, yeah, it doesn't really work. Thing is, political context, we can't release them because they're foreign criminals, and if the press hears about it, then we're for the high jumps. So we just keep them locked up until the courts release them. Yeah, we're happy to talk to you about how we do that, but bottom line is we have to lock them up. So that got me thinking, this is going to be tricky. Not that we didn't know that. So how do you change the political context? And 5 years on, what I'm going to try and explain and justify is that the political context has changed. The Home Office is closing detention centres. Closed to Haslar and Dover last year. Expansion of Campsfield was cancelled after huge mobilisation around Oxford. The numbers in detention went down by 26% in 3 months at the end of last year. And the government, for the first time, is acknowledging that detention is a problem. They've been getting it wrong. They need to do it less. They need to detain people for less time. Basically, they are accepting the narrative that many of us have been saying for years. Why has this happened? We've been saying all this stuff for years. People have been demonstrating against Campsfield for years. Why are we suddenly winning when we lost for so long? So I believe that it's... I'm going to try and map out how I see this process has happened. And I think it's really important that we understand this, partly because we've only just started winning. There are still many people in detention. There are still many people who shouldn't be in detention who are there for very long periods. So there's a long way to go, and we need to understand how we've got this momentum and how we can keep it up and close many more detention centres. And I think it has to start in places like this, in civil society. This is where the momentum is coming from. It's coming from communities affected by detention, people leaving detention with the appalling stories, their appalling experiences in detention, people in detention protesting, speaking out. We're going to hear more from Jane and Antonia about that. The media impact of the campaigning in Yarswood, for example. Detention has become an issue, and it's become an issue in a way that's politically powerful. I think to understand how it's politically powerful, we have to look at where power lies in the British political system. So many years ago, I did a politics degree, and what they taught us was the British Constitution. It's the executive, the legislature, and the judiciary. That's the seat of authority in our government. It's the government, parliament, and the courts, basically. And I think what we've seen over the last couple of years is all three of those seats of power going into taking very different approach views than they have in the past as a direct result of all this community mobilisation. So to start with the legislature, the parliament, I think this is where it's the route from communities to power is most direct. We've seen this huge mobilisation across the country, across different, not just London, not just places where there are detention centres, but cities affected by detention because people are coming back from detention to them. I think this is really, the effectiveness of this is really traceable back to a large extent to the way that these groups, these campaigns are working together. The Detention Forum was set up in 2009 as a strategic space for those of us working campaigning on detention to come together, to work together, to strategise so that we're more than the sum of our parts rather than just being lots of little campaigns around the country, not talking to each other, and talking to John McDonnell and Jeremy Corbyn, which at the time seemed not very effective. Now it's slightly changed, of course, but what we did was we developed a theory, a shared campaign strategy for focusing on the key injustices of detention. So particularly the lack of a time limit, that people are locked up without a time limit, uniquely in Europe, and frequently for periods of years. It's a horrendous effect on their lives, their families, their communities, and it's completely unnecessary. No other European country does this. So we strategised, we shared our activities, we worked extensively with people who had direct personal experience of this. So my organisation works with a self-advocacy group called Free Voices, with experts by experience who've been detained for a total of around 30 years, I think. They speak with a great deal more authority than me about what the reality of indefinite detention is. And they're not just speaking in communities, they're speaking in Parliament, in places where power is. So we work together, we all lobbied our MPs. There's a huge amount of work here with Nicola Blackwood, who obviously is a Conservative, not a typical No Borders, certainly not a No Borders supporter, but there were these mobilisations around the country to bring in MPs who are not normally the friends of the likes of us, to see that detention, even from their point of view, is not working. It's harmful, it's against their religious values, their belief in small government and not and civil liberties. So I think that we created this sense that it's not just coming from a couple of NGOs. This is a community issue across the country, in my constituency as an MP. And it's, MPs feel so much more confident picking up an issue if they're hearing about it locally. So we worked gradually on them. We held a series of parliamentary meetings, which led Sarah Tether, back in the days we had Lib Dem MPs, if you remember that far, to set up a parliamentary inquiry, first ever parliamentary inquiry into the whole of the detention system. And she managed to bring on a cross-party panel from spanning the full political spectrum, from some fairly right-wing Tories right across. And they had a series of hearings, and they heard from the likes of me, but much more importantly, much more powerfully, they heard from people who'd experienced it. They had one session where they were phoning into Colmbrook, and they talked to one guy who's now on the Free Voices group, who told about his experience of being trafficked and detention, and they asked, how long have you been detained? And he said, 3 years. And there was this sort of intake of breath in the room, and you could see all these Conservative MPs looking really shaken. So by the time they published that report, it was no longer a shock to us that they followed the detention forum's line of 28 days, that should be the limit. It was no longer a shock that they made a coruscating critique of the unnecessary, inefficient, harmful use of detention. It was no longer a shock when Theresa May responded by announcing her own inquiry. We all thought it was going to be the long grass. But by the time the Shaw Review came out, the Home Secretary's inquiry in January, it was actually no longer a shock that it was very similar. Didn't go as far as the parliamentary inquiry, didn't call for a time limit. But if you read 350 pages, but if you read the detail, the picture it presents is our narrative. It's the same critique we've all been saying. This is harmful, it's not working, it must change. The difference, when I say it, government, not interested, when people who've been detained say it, government's not interested, but when Stephen Shaw says it, the minister, for the first time, says, we accept the broad thrust of the review, we are holding our own reform programme. We expect there to be less people in detention for less time. Now, how much faith do you have in the good intention? The very vague good intentions of James Brockenshire is open to debate. I'm sure there'll be a range of opinions. But, as I say, we are seeing shifts. We are seeing detention centres closing. My organisation's gone out. We work in three of the centres, and we are seeing them going through the long-term detained people and quietly releasing them. This is not being... They're not announcing any of this, but most of the people... The Free Voices group, we're struggling to get them in a room these days because there's so many people being released. So it's changing. Meanwhile, in the courts, the detained fast track has ceased, and we now think it's not coming back, which when my organisation, Detention Action, started our litigation 4 years ago, seemed a very remote prospect because it was simply politically implausible. And our legal team, our lawyers, would say, every time we asked for advice on the chances of closing down the fast track, they'd say, well, in law, we have a really strong case. In practice, it will take a brave judge. So, it's only when you start suing the government you realise how much politics there is in even the legal system. At every stage, the key question was not the strength of our legal arguments, but the extent to which judges would feel they had the political courage, political leeway to upset the government on something. The government's arguments were very much, this is a detaining asylum seekers, sorry, I should explain the fast track in case anyone here isn't aware. It's the accelerated detained asylum process, whereby asylum seekers are taken, you claim asylum, you what, should use the past tense, you were taken straight to detention. The government would say your case was suitable for a quick decision. What that meant, no one ever defined. They made a quick decision. It was a refusal, so that proved that they were right. They'd made their quick decision. And you had 3 days to appeal. If you needed evidence, you're sorry, but pretty much. So, and then you lose your appeal because you haven't had time to get evidence because you're locked up and you've had 3 days. So it's a closed circle. It was a system for taking out about 30% of the asylum claims and refusing them quickly and getting them on planes. As a result, talking to Home Office about this, we tried talking about some of the most obvious inequities, such as the way they were leaving people in detention for 2-4 weeks at the start before they'd even start this very, very fast process without lawyers. They weren't interested. Politically, ministers loved it. It was the one bit of the asylum system that they thought was really great. They were absolutely not interested in even thinking about how they were getting these great results. So litigation seemed like the only option. And initially, when we brought our legal challenge, the whole system was so unfair as to be unlawful. Perhaps inevitably we got the most famously hostile xenophobic judge in the High Court. I'm told it wasn't a coincidence. He spent well over 6 months coming up with the most arcane way of allowing our challenge, so we won, but in a way that would have the absolute minimum of difference. So that we couldn't appeal because we'd won, in theory, and the Home Office could tweak and carry on. So I won't go through the increasingly arcane of what happened next, but another year of litigation, a whole new legal challenge focusing on the judicial machinery. Later, 5 full hearings, so 5 judgments, each one, apart from the one we lost, went slightly further than the previous one. So the point I'm making is that judges are part of the political context. Judges are reading the press. Judges are reading the parliamentary inquiry. Judges are reading the previous judgments. So you each challenge, when that first xenophobic judge, even he felt he had to let us win in a little way, that emboldened the next judge to go a bit further, the next judge to go a bit further. And suddenly you get to the point that without any judge ever saying, fast track's unlawful, it's got to stop. The whole thing topples over and seems to now be dead. They are still detaining some asylum seekers, which we can talk about later maybe if you want to go into that. But the numbers are much smaller and 70% are being released. So it's very, very different from the fast track. And I'm running out of time, I think, so just... So to move on to the final area of my little map of power in the UK is obviously the government, the executive. So my old friend from criminal casework who has moved on happily, but how do you fundamentally change any of this when it's the Home Office it's the Home Office that lock people up? The Home Office that has often seemed almost immune from parliamentary judicial control. They get found unlawful, they get criticised in Parliament, they just carry on. Solutions have to involve changing the Home Office in some way. And that, I think, comes back partly to my starting point of talking about costs, talking about efficiency, and talking about the reasons why Home Office thinks it needs to detain people. They say they're detaining people because it's necessary to remove them, because otherwise they abscond, because otherwise they commit crimes. So we need, there's some of us within this, not all of us, and civil society engagement needs to be the whole spectrum, I think, from principled arguments for no borders, the long term, the long view, to technicalities that address Home Office concerns that can actually change things now. Some of us need to be talking to the Home Office about why they have been thinking they needed detention and how it can be done otherwise. And this is where alternatives to detention come in. This is, I think, and not everyone agrees with me, but this is, I think, how we make this change long-term, sustainable, permanent. So the next xenophobic turn in our politics, detention reform continues. The strength of the UK is precisely communities. We have people like the people in this room, in this building, who are working with asylum seekers, with migrants, who are providing support, helping them to fight their cases, to engage with the system. It's not... the government perception is that when they release them from detention, they just disappear into this void. But it's not the reality. It's detention, it's the void, if anything. So the fear of absconding is really... it's a chimera that comes out of Home Office ignorance of the support that already exists in the community. That can help people to participate with the asylum process, participate with the immigration process, try and resolve their cases. So my organisation is running a small project with young ex-offenders, so people who get detained for 2-3 years because they don't have documents, they can't go back, and they're foreign criminals, inverted commas, so the Home Office has been refusing to release them. So we've developed this project to show to the Home Office that we can work with these guys in the community. They don't abscond, they don't offend, they get involved in volunteering and join football teams and do all the stuff that normal people do. It's shock horror, they're not monsters, they are normal guys. They're a bit angrier because they've had horrible lives and been treated horribly by the Home Office. But if treat them with respect and they won't abscond. 2 years in, we've had the first 22 clients, I think, we've had one reconviction for possession of cannabis. Virtually everyone has kept in touch with the Home Office. No one's been documented or forcibly removed. So, and Home Office are are now really talking to us, and we've started they've started agreeing to release people onto our project because they can see that actually this is a way of getting, it is a problem for them that they're wasting all this money on detention. Political context has changed, so they no longer feel obliged to just lock people up and throw away the key. And we're there presenting solutions that enable them, within their own immigration control mindset, to see that, well, detention is not necessary. They can do without detention in all sorts of different situations. I think that's the long-term, the way that we can potentially change the immigration, the whole immigration system, ultimately, to a system that's based not on enforcement, not on just detaining people and brutalising them, but engaging with migrants so that there's a fair system, people have the chance to be heard, people have the chance to resolve their case without being locked up in detention. And communities are at the heart of that. Thank you.
I'm going to ask you all to hold the questions that you've got. We're going to have time for several rounds of questions at the end for sort of both sets of speakers and organisations. So it's my pleasure to introduce Antonia Bright, who's a founding member and a key organiser in Movement for Justice. And Jane Sally, who's also a member of Movement for Justice and who's been campaigning on immigration issues. Movement for Justice, as you'll explain, is a grassroots organisation, describes itself as a mass militant civil rights movement focusing on immigrant rights and anti-racist campaigns. And over the last 18 months or so, they've been leading prominent demonstrations and resistance inside and outside detention. So in their 20 minutes, they're going to talk about the challenges people face in detention and how they've been working for change and kind of opportunities and challenges within that process.
We should stand up so you're not in the light of the...
Yeah.
You shouldn't stare into those things in the rest of your eyes. I'm just going to actually pass a couple of things because I think it helps to... follow what we're saying. So there's a big thing and a small thing. So I was just going to say a little of where we're kind of coming from and then be able to talk a bit about the detention, particularly Yarlsburg. One of the things that I just passed was a Movement for Justice pledge, which kind of lays out who we are and what we stand for in the most clearest way. And we see from it that it isn't limited to questions of immigration, detention, and so on. This is one part, but for us a really central and crucially important part of how oppression and how the anti-immigrant bigotry is heightened and is just central in any fight for progress in our society. We feel like the questions of detention is a central part of the questions of all the immigration controls, and that is a central part of the divide and rule policies of the government. A progressive movement in Britain has to stand up against detention and has to stand up as people with and without papers, citizens and non-citizens. That's the kind of movement we need to be able to win. So one of the pledges that I was picking out was just to say that I'm just going to read out this one. It says, "I pledge to accept the challenge of becoming my generation's voice of freedom. I know this requires always speaking for and to the oppressed, speaking the plain truth about racism and inequality, and expressing both the anger and the aspirations of our communities. I reject the popular, wrong, and dominant ideology of most of those who claim to support progressive regime reforms, who say that the only people that can make and change history are the rich and powerful. Accepting this false assumption places the oppressed and poor in the dead-end position of having no alternatives other than making moral appeals to the rich and the powers that be, or trying to find clever arguments to convince them that granting our demands will make it easier for them to exploit us. Those who are in power and currently decide the social, economic, and political policies of our nation are completely aware that their determination to prioritise profits over people causes the vast majority of the world's people to live in squalor and despair. We can only change the actions and attitudes of the rich and powerful and their political representatives if we assert the superior power and will of the oppressed and exploited through mass action. This is the only road to victory. I picked this one out because speaking the plain truth about racism, being able to do that, regardless of not thinking in terms of can we gain the sympathy of our oppressor and convince them to be nicer to us, but speaking the plain truth about racism and accepting all the awkwardness and friction that that creates, because our lives are full of friction anyway. And until we can speak the plain truth about it and name it and be open about it, we can't hope for change. And the point that the people that oppress us know that they do damage in people's lives, I think, as you were just saying earlier, they know it's a political question. It's not that they didn't realise that people were being damaged throughout detention. It's not that this is a shock to them. For those who have looked at it, they know. It's really, frankly, obvious. And there have been years and years worth of reports, you know, quantifying that and describing that. That isn't the reason they do it. Detention proves that the government is tough on immigration, and making the promise to citizens that to be tough on immigration is a promise that a hollow promise that your lives will be better because we've clamped down hard on these other people. It's a false promise. It's a lie to citizens. Life does not get better every time they get tough on immigration. But politically, it is a lie that they've relied on. And it does divide the community. So for Movement for Justice, we see the questions of racism as one of the most important dividing rule tactics. There are lots of oppression, and we'll fight against all of them. But this particularly, it just is particularly important because of how efficient it does divide, and the fact that we can even be in a world where we can now say that people are allowed to drown in the sea rather than be rescued, ought to drive it home that this dividing rule, this anti-immigrant bigotry and racism, is of that much importance. This is what it's created. This is where the kind of policies have led. And I think that it's okay, because they don't have any solution to the problems that have been created, the economic and political, the climate change, the, all the things that are problems in our world. They don't have a solution to it. So locking poor people into poor countries, dividing the society along racial and immigration lines, is their plan. Is their plan B? There's no plan A. So we have to fight. And so for us, where we see the change coming is we have to be able to speak the plain truth. So, and we have to build the kind of movement on that basis that that can bring together people that want to fight back, people that do know that truth and you know, want to see that change, have to feel inspired, like have to feel like what I go through, you know, I can express. That is the way to win. Hiding it, trying to be polite, being in that habit of not mentioning racism when something is racist. It's very common for people to mitigate, tone down and so on, what they experience. But the problem is that's not going to win. And it just really lets off the hook the powers that be. So in the interest of building that kind of movement, sorry, I did write a couple of minutes. Okay. We've got a situation where we've been able to organise increasing demonstrations and growing demonstrations at detention centres. We began going to detention centres to lead protests because of the struggle that was going on inside. Part of the reason that there was a struggle going on inside is because there's always a struggle inside. Because if you're in that situation, you are in a struggle, you're in a fight. Whether you know how to win that fight, whether you feel like there's other people around you, you know, supporting you enough that you can win, is a different matter. But that the fight exists is always true. If you put people in detention, there will be resistance to detention. There is always resistance to detention. Detention gets more and more closer to prison because it can't just be open and residential units, because people are going to keep fighting because you're not free. And you know that you're being set up to fail. If you were on detained fast track, you learn very fast that you are being set up to fail. This is a miscarriage of justice being carried out against you. There's no, you don't need someone to tell you that. It's what it is. We started going, and in part, the other part of like those struggles was because of the challenges around fast track as well. People knew that there was a challenge going on to fast track, and they know they're going through fast track. And if bits of fast track are being found unlawful here and there, then they're like, well, why am I still here? Why am I still being put through it? So then again, you have like the hope that things are teetering on changing, but the change isn't coming fast enough, and you have to fight. And I think that it is it's a back and forth thing with the challenge against detention. So we went because we wanted to escalate. We felt like we have to do things outside that help elevate and escalate that struggle that's going on inside. If we're going to make these struggles that are going on inevitably into struggles that can win, we need to organise. We need to organise inside and outside detention. And that if we do that, it is going to shift the whole political context. It's going to shift the context in which those judges are making those decisions. Because the state will continue with its oppression while they feel that that is an efficient way of getting away with what they want to do. There isn't a reason for them to stop. Their question isn't whether people are suffering, because they already know that. Their question is, are people going to accept that suffering? Are people going to put up with it? Are we going to get away with it? Can we carry on with it? So when they had their plan was to expand detention. By now they were supposed to have more detention, not less. So when we were going to the detention, we were saying to the people inside, if we set a time of the day and we demonstrate outside, and you tell everyone you know, you tell everyone inside and anyone who has contacts outside, and we tell everyone we know outside, we can do a demonstration that's joint. Like, you're a part of it, we're a part of it, and we can start to bring the kind of publicity onto this and bring more people who weren't affected before, or more people who know someone inside but they don't know what to do about it. Like, they don't know how they can do anything to help, to calm outside. And we started there, and the majority of the people on the demonstration, the Movement for Justice People, is people in their own struggle with the Home Office, people seeking asylum, people who have been in detention. But the fact that people who have been in detention could come outside and demonstrate and shout and bang the fences and hold up signs and placards, and we could call people inside and they could speak directly, and people outside would say, yeah, I was in there before and now I'm out here and I'm still fighting. You can fight. You can keep fighting. The impact of that, in terms of, you know, you need people to be able to make a decision to fight, to make decisions on a day-to-day basis to be stronger and to keep fighting. And it had that kind of impact. So then we had to keep coming back. We didn't know if it would work the first time we went, but it was really powerful, even with about 40, 50 people, you know, outside Harmondsworth and Colenbrook. We've had now up to 2,000 people at Yarlsworth demonstrating. As you can see, the windows are all the windows where detainees are held. Seeing and feeling that power, that you aren't on your own and that what's happening to you is not invisible. And to, I guess, the political elite, to feel like detention, you might want to carry on with detention, but you're not going to have a stable, calm, peaceful, easy to abuse detention system. You're not going to have the choice to keep it private, isolated, invisible, because there's a movement now, and people who have had nothing to do with detention in the past are now making it their business to come to demonstrations and to speak out on their campuses or organise meetings and hearings and things to talk about this as a central example of the kind of abuse and racism and sexism and homophobia that the government is perpetuating right here in the UK. And the things that they point to other countries and complain about that other countries do is something happening here. That means it's just not an option for them to keep it invisible. That means there has to be a different decision. It has an impact on whether they can feel that it's viable or reliable as a means to isolate and separate people and achieve those quick and easy decisions and deportations. And I would say it's not as reliable anymore. And we're seeing a reduction in detention, as Jerome was saying. We're also seeing new criminal offences to impose on people, to criminalise more people, to be in that category of foreign national offender. So if you rent a place to live, if you work a job, it will now be a criminal offence if you don't have papers. And so they have their alternative way of categorising people in a way that then they'll be in a legal category where it's easier to get deportation order, much harder for a person to fight their case. It will affect people that would have been asylum seeking, maybe asylum seeking. Sorry, I'm talking too long. I just wanted to say that's like their alternative plan. And that means that's more of a fight in the community. It means in the community, and the community's resistance is incredibly important, not to allow that kind of criminalisation. You know, but in Britain, it is true, this is a community that can do it. We have communities that can make that fight. So I talk way too long, I'm sorry. I know there's chance for like people to ask questions, but I was going to James to say, because you were in Yarlswood, not with the first demonstration, but we've gone in like April, May, June, August to these demonstrations, like the pictures. But you were inside Yarlswood when we went in November. And so you were there when all the build-up to the demonstration happened, and then the demonstration happened. You were going to say something about it.
Today I'm very happy to meet you, all of you here. This is my important, I don't know how I can explain to you. Today is my birthday.
Really?
That is why I'm very happy today here. Okay, for me, I was detained in 2015. I had gone for sign-on. I signed only for 4 months, and then I was taken to Yarlswood. I think I was in one of these windows when Movement for Justice came in, fight for us. We organized ourselves inside before they came, so that we can fight with them. For us who were inside and those who came to fight for us. When they came, okay, I spent there almost 2 months in Yarlswood. But what I saw and what I got from Yarlswood, I don't want to remember, I have left it there, but it was terrible. Good enough, I came out. When Movement for Justice came, we organized ourselves, we had our group leaders inside there. They told us, please, we have to unite here from Yarlswood so that when these people come, we fight from inside, they fight from outside. That is how we fought and have been fighting. And when I was released, I joined that Movement for... I had it before. I was in Movement for Justice. Then we had to build again. I used to invite my friends who were there together, and now we have a big group, which is for fight for justice. No detention, no deportation. Because some of us who come from different countries, we have different issues, we have different problems. That is why we are fighting for everybody not be discriminated.
That is what moving is.
Can you say, like, what you did? What things were people doing in preparing for the demonstration?
Inside, when we were inside?
Yeah.
When we were inside, we used to sit in our community, small community. Those who could follow us, we used to sit and discuss. And we didn't want to do it in general, because some of them, they don't care. They are thinking they have other issues. For us, when we sat there, we said, let's not do this. Because if we don't fight from here, nobody's going to listen to us. Nobody's going to know how we are suffering in this year's world. And we are there about, the years will accommodate about 450 detainees, 400 people from different countries. They are couples, they are from different countries, like Africa, Asia, different countries. So, me, I'm from Uganda. I had my friends, about four of them from Uganda. Nigeria, Ghana, so we had Zambia, African countries. So we had to sit and think about it. But we never were about 14, sitting, fighting. The guards can come and ask you, what are you doing here? Just keep quiet. Because for us, we knew what to do. Because if you tell them that you are doing this, they might take you somewhere in the room and lock you there, not to put fire in other people so that they can do a demonstration inside. So we organized ourselves, movement came, for justice came, they were there fighting, showing their sympathy for us. So one time, I was at the dining room, and there's a girl, you know, she's out also. She came to me. She was telling me that they are taking someone. Can you come? They are going to handcuff her. Can you come and resist? I said, okay. But the guards were on me. When she went, they came to me like this. What has she been telling you? I said, okay. She was asking me whether that girl has had her dinner here. And that was so. Then they followed her. Immediately, she disappeared. And then they came to me again, tell us. And I told them, what I have said is that. She was asking me whether I have seen her. I hadn't seen her. So you see, I was scared. I was very, very much scared. The way they came to me, I was very, very scared. I couldn't eat anymore. By the time I came up from Yazoo, I was terrible. Even there, I don't know. It was terrible. Because they can't listen to you. The day I was detained, my heart rate pressure was up. When we were going to Yazoo, I asked the officer, can I get some medicine? I have my medicine in my bag. They said no. On the way, I asked the officer again, can I get my medicine? What can I do for you? I said, I'm dying. I don't feel okay. At least water. No, I can't do anything for you. We reached there around 9. But by the time they located us in the rooms, it was 4 in the morning. My patients were almost dying. Until some nurses came and they took my blood pressure, whatever, and they gave me medicine. So it kept on. Every day, every after 2 days, I had to see a doctor. Until they interviewed me from there, they gave my application that is related. I said, until they brought a doctor, she had to examine me, my scars, my whatever, and the report she gave, that is why I was released. So I'm fighting. I call upon you to join us so that we fight for freedom. Thank you very much.
Okay, yeah. So we've had two very eloquent explanations of quite different approaches that we've taken to challenging the issue of immigration and detention. I think you can see why these are both really kind of dynamic, like I said at the beginning, dynamic and impactful responses to the issue. I'm sure many people here have got experience that's relevant and have got interesting questions. So what we're going to do is follow the general pattern in the conference so far and collect a few questions, comments that you can come through the brief so we can collect as much as possible, and then kind of come back to the speakers for their input. Okay. Great, we've got one, two, and three.
I've had experience as an expert witness for people under detention in Castfield over a 10-year period, particularly. What I found was that the process was being tightened down in two or three different ways. One was that when hearings were scheduled, they were always someplace far away from Oxford, in Birmingham, at Heathrow, wherever. So the detainee, myself as an expert witness, the solicitor would go, and then it was suspended because the representative from the Home Office wasn't there. This could happen 5, 6, 7 times. So the detention process was stretching out 2 years. Years and years, more than 3 years, some people in the 1990s, I promise you. The other pernicious thing was that there was an initiative to have bails paid for people to be released. At the beginning, the amount was relatively small, and so many people contributed £1,000, and then it was increased. 2,000, 5,000, 10,000. So the numbers of people who were in a position to pay a bail for somebody to be released, which was a guarantee against abscondment, diminished over time. That meant that more and more people couldn't become free. So I'd like us to think about these two aspects particularly, because I think, in a positive way, as you've described, Thurum, that we need to address shortening the time of detention and eliminating it completely.
Thank you. My question is really to Jerome. It's quite a specific thing. I'm one of Nicola Blackwood's constituents, and I had emailed her concerning the expansion of Campsfield, and I was actually really pleasantly surprised when she opposed the extension. I mean, I don't think she came out and opposed the whole detention system, but I wondered what sort of background information you've got on that could, you know, help us for campaigning in the future.
No, it's really interesting. I have lots of questions and I'm trying to think about what is the most relevant. One question for Jane. Do you see a lot of people coming out from detention who then want to be active, then want to join some sort of movement, some sort of campaign afterwards? Or do you see that actually people, once they are released, they just want to get on with their life? And how do you... what do you see are the reasons why people decide to then continue the fight or not? That's one question. And then I have another question for Antonia. Because before we talked about, in the previous session, about, we are trying to preach into the choir of the converted sometimes, and how do we get people who are either unsure or they are not aware or perhaps opposing immigration, and how something like your movement, which is quite bold and, you know, powerful but also quite confrontational, can engage with that. Yeah, actually, I also have a question for this introduction. Because you talked a lot about engaging with the government. And the civil society element was a bit missing from the discussion. And I wonder whether the fact that whether lobbying specifically the government and doing things like strategic litigation is something that you see as a strategy more fruitful than try to mobilize civil society.
There's kind of two parts. There were a bunch of questions directed to you, so I'm thinking that question about the balance of work between working with government, working with civil society. You also asked about the closed campus fields that would stop the expansion campaign, what changed the political support. And then there were comments around the inconvenience of the location hearings and the cost increase in surety costs.
Yes, I mean, I might let Jill, I mean, that was going to, on the council, I know that my answer to you is very much a local thing, so I know Jill...
Okay, I've just got two points I'd like to ask about. From my point of view, one of the huge problems is the initial decision to detain people who come here. And the Guardian recently exposed the system now in use where the people who interview recently arrived or recently arrested asylum seekers or migrants are now actually GAP students, GAP year students, many of them. I don't know if any other people saw this in the Guardian. Yes, it was a large article about how it had been exposed, which was by a complete freak chance that somebody who had been in detention but was released made friends with the family and 2 years later came back to visit the family, and their son was doing this work, who was a gap year student. And so what do we think about that? But the other thing I want to raise is that the government has some policies which for them aren't too bad. For us, they would still be bad, but even those they don't stick to. The huge amount of occasions which I come across the site, I go into council a lot, and I'm registered OISC, so I can give legal advice. The practice and the policies are so far apart, and where the law is not adhered to, and nobody is picking it up. And this happens at the first tier tribunals. Because of the council campaign and the research work we've done published, two of us go to the stakeholders' meetings of the immigration tribunals. We were invited because they wanted us in rather than out, so that they knew what we were doing. And it happens there as well that the practice is so bad, like the way judges operate and so on. And the policies seem to glide over it. And they say, we have the policies in place. And I asked about making complaints about the bear hoarding. And Michael Clements, who's the senior judge in charge of the first year tribunal, said to me, surely you can look up on the internet what our complaints procedure is. And this was the you poor little old lady thing, you know. And I said, I'm perfectly able to do that, and your complaints procedure is useless, because all you get is wait 4 months and then get a letter saying there's no merit in your complaint. And he just says, next business.
Thank you.
So that's the sort of thing. Yeah.
So a bunch of issues there, I guess, around process and procedure, and then also around the
Yes, I mean, I think the Oxford campaign is a pretty good example to go to a couple of the questions, actually. It was very much one as a local issue. It wasn't talking to government. It wasn't government lobbying. It was local people in the constituency, not you, that the campaign's here, mobilising, engaging their local MP, that this was a local issue that was going to cause harm around here, that people in the constituency really cared about. And that gave Nicola Blackwood, who was a new MP, not relatively new, not necessarily that confident, she felt that there was enough of a local mobilisation here that she could put her neck out opposing government policy. And she was, from what I hear, doing a lot of behind-the-scenes lobbying of the minister against this, and initially getting a very hostile response. And as, I mean, this was really the first big win of this detention reform success over the last year. As the parliamentary inquiry came out, as they started backing down on Haslar, suddenly Huddersfield expansion, as Antonia mentioned, the plan to have 5,000 detention spaces went out the window, and the government was made a complete hot fuss on that. And it was because they had voices coming from the right, which had been mobilised by communities. So I think what I was really trying to bring out in my presentation was precisely that it's not government lobbying, it's not the likes of me talking to ministers or senior officials. It's what happens in the community and constituencies, in the body politic as a whole, that shapes how parliamentarians see this issue, knowing that it's not something where the majority of the population is on side. But if they feel like there's enough people in their constituency who might vote them out because of it, that focuses minds. This creates the campaigning, the media work, the people speaking out, changes the political context within which those decisions at the heart of power get made by judges, by ministers. I focused much more on the important part is the community mobilisation, those conversations. What we've achieved is connecting those up with the lobbying that comes afterwards. And leading, for example, to the legislative changes in the Immigration Act, which was intended to be very much a cracking down on immigration, hostile environment act, and ended up featuring bits of good time limit for 72 hours for pregnant women and automatic judicial oversight for the first time. Small steps. And I totally take Joel's point that bail is... Bail Observation Project have published very compelling research that the bail system's not working. But I think that there's potential for the political context to change here. Once Parliament is saying, well, actually, you have to have bail hearings every 4 months because this is a really important safeguard on a major infringement of the right to liberty, the hope is that even those immigration tribunal judges will start to see that the sands are shifting and they might have to start taking their responsibilities a bit more seriously.
Thank you. And I guess that's a good segue into talking about the issue around kind of raising awareness in communities and experiences of people speaking out that you've got firsthand.
Yeah, there was a question about how to engage in people. One of the things that I feel like to say, because I'm not sure everyone, I think there's an overwhelming kind of an anti-immigrant, you know, media, you know, effort and so on. And that can be overwhelming, but I think it's very important not to make the same assumptions that the media or the politicians may make. I don't accept that people are as racist as they make out. I don't think that that's the case. I don't think it's the case that people would support things about detention. I think there's a reason that they're so private and isolated and not known about in the general public. It's because there would be an outcry, that people would be angry about it. So much as there's hostility around immigration that's really exacerbated and kind of encouraged, you know, if you just kind of went by the media and so on, underneath that, there's a lot of lies to people to get people to feel that way. So I feel like there's a lot of scope for a movement to win people over, and it is obviously essential that we do. We need to win this argument, but we can. So with the protests, for example, we've seen a lot of people coming who didn't really know, honestly, much about detention before.
and the impact of going, people have come away saying that was the best demonstration I've ever been on. So, like, from activists who go on demonstrations to feel in a special, particular way inspired by this, and to have that energy to go back and tell other people, you know, in their college or university or whatever, by and large younger people, to be able to go back and be that enthused, are winning other people over to then come to the next one. And alongside people coming out of detention, you know, your question, that's having a knock-on effect, and I think these things overlap, because in a lot of ways there's an impact from around that, for example, has an impact on other decisions people make or other things going on. So, for example, in May there was a day of action against all the detention centres, and it went even beyond Britain to other countries as well. And the reason that people even felt there was scope, that it was possible, you know, and like realistic to think we could call demonstrations at all the detention centres on the same day and have enough people show up to make real demonstrations at all the places, happened on the 7th of May. We went back to Yarsley, we had at least around 300 people. I think there was about 400 people at Dungable, there was people at Morton Hall, you know, at Campsfield, at all over the place. That's a huge change. It's a political shift, and I think it means that there's kind of a divide between, on the one hand, like, there's still that anti-immigrant racist bigotry, but on the other hand, there's a lot of ways that people are expressing the opposite sentiment. So we have a kind of division, which, you know, makes sense. And within that, we've just got to do the work. We've got to organise in our communities more public hearings and speak outs, protests, petitions, all everything we can do, and get more people to. And I think that detention becomes a problem. Like, the growth of detention actually becomes a problem for detention, because it actually affects a hell of a lot of people. So there's a lot of people, more than you might expect, who are affected, either themselves or a family member or a friend or a neighbour or a classmate has been in detention. If you start speaking out about detention, someone in the room is going to say, oh, actually, I was there. If it's in any FE college, there's going to be, you know, with any sort of sizable, you know, black and Asian, you know, like, student body, there's going to be someone there who knows more directly about it. We've found that so many times because we're fighting. There's a lot of stigma and shame around detention, but building a movement changes that. Once someone can then say, yeah, I was in detention, without expecting just the shame from all their classmates or whatever, but to feel like, you know, to be fighting and to see people around you fighting, then you can start talking about it. Then people have to think differently about immigration, because then detention becomes like a place that has focused people's minds on all the stuff they say about detention, about immigration, and how people are cheating, this, that, and the other. It's different when you actually look at a real situation and you know someone who's gone through it. You have to think about differently, not just about detention, but the whole anti-immigrant policy and the whole intent of that policy and the politics behind it and what it's actually doing. So if it becomes like a focus, I think this is what the problem with, this is what will shut down detention. Not because it's bad for the people going through it, but because it is a place that concentrates and focuses a movement that's fighting against that racist policy, and it becomes the place that most exposes what the real content of that racist anti-immigrant policy is. Apart from people drowning in the sea, the part that's right here on our doorstep is this.
And there was also a question that, rather more specifically, about speaking out when you've had experience of detention yourself and what that was like, and
yeah,
more people can get in.
Yes, there are more people joining the Movement for Justice who have been detained. And you have even those who have never been in Yarsley or in any detention centre, they are joining the Movement for Justice to fight against this is a discrimination. So, yes, different. Like, I will come to join Movement for Justice and we fight
I think what the letter is also asking is to do with the fear that people might have about speaking out. And do you find that's very common, that people are fearful to speak out about detention?
Yes, some people they do, but according to the people I've met who have been in Yazoo, they are not open to speak about it.
On that, just there was something you said on the train up here, when you're looking out the windows and seeing people that used to be inside, you were saying, do you want to say that again?
When?
Well, when we were coming out, we were talking about that same question you just asked. Do people, when they come out of detention, join the demonstrations, feel confident? And you were saying that when you're inside, people recognised some of the people outside.
Yes, indeed. And even when we went back there, was it May?
Yeah.
There's a friend of mine who phoned me and told me that we saw you, someone inside there at Yazoo, saw you demonstrating outside and said, yes, that is it.
We're actually on time to finish, but I think there's more energy here, so maybe we'll take another round if we can keep it brief questions and come back to the panel to finish up. We've got one there, and there's one over here.
It's just to ask.
Okay. If we start with you.
I just wanted to really ask this wider question. I think in Britain we lock up a higher proportion of our population than any other European country, but we've seen a recent idea that maybe we need to close on these prisons, and the wider societal costs need to be taken into account. Here we are talking about detention centres, which are worse places to be than prisons, we've also heard. I just wonder whether or not some of the momentum to close detention centres might be linked to this realisation that locking up people isn't much of an answer, whether you can make capital out of that.
Great, thank you.
But it's a question really for Antonio and Jane. I'm from Exeter, and if you look at me, you see this is what Exeter looks like: grey, old, white, and generally fairly pacifist, I would say. And so going to the detention centre and demonstrating is probably not what people will do as first line. They'd probably support your own charity. But what I wanted to know is, for Jane really, when you, after the demonstration, after everybody had gone and the detention centre was tidied up, and were the staff more hostile to you, less hostile, more sympathetic? How was your treatment in the days, the hours and the days after the demonstration?
Thank you.
I've got two questions. One is that you've had some success if they're closing down the detention centres. How can we apply that success to other aspects of what's going on in the whole immigration debate? What can we learn from it, and how can we keep that momentum going? And the other thing is just a practical thing: can everyone make sure that they've signed one of these? And I've got one on finished by Phyllis Ferguson. I don't know who it is. Okay, thanks.
Great. So we've got a question around the link to prison reform, about response to demonstrations inside, and links between detention and wider immigration issues, and kind of success in the
I think the prison reform point is a really good one, a really important one. We always used to say that we were 20 years behind the prison reform movement. I think we're catching up. It's helpful for us because prison reform is a mainstream political narrative, while there is still this very much Anglo culture of the solutions of social problems is locking people up and is it in US, Australian prison policy and detention policy, and that's clearly quite deep rooted because they haven't sorted it out in prisons either. It does help, I think, to the phrase detention reform is partly to invoke that the sense that there's recognition fairly broad in our society that prison doesn't work, and that alternatives to custody are cheaper and more effective, and particularly around the intersection with offenders in detention, that's something that we've cleared. There are risks of contributing to the criminalisation of detention, of course, as well, so it's a fine line, but where detention is being justified specifically for risk of offending grounds, we've done quite a lot of. Our project is, we have an ex-probation officer involved in it, for example. So we're trying to bring in quite a lot of the learning from the limited successes of prison reform to influence detention reform. And yes, another really good question around wider immigration reform. Because I think, in some ways, I think the strength and potential weakness of the detention reform is that it both leads into and almost requires reform of immigration asylum systems in general, and that's really where the alternative to detention narrative goes. That, as Antonia was saying, that detaining people is really problematic. It's becoming increasingly so in all sorts of ways, and whereas working with communities, working with people in the communities, having fair, comprehensible systems that actually resolve cases, and get them right. Have sufficient experience, people making evidence-based decisions, is actually in everyone's interest. And if you have systems that treat people as human beings, that involve engaging with migrants, understanding their situations, understanding their asylum claims, having that human interaction, this is basically the Swedish model, which we've been talking about for a while, and worked very well for the Swedish government, as well as for people, most, not everyone, but a lot of people who get claim asylum in Sweden. There are reasons why people try to get to Sweden. So I think there's potentially a real common interest that could widen out detention reform into changing the whole immigration asylum system.
Thank you.
I'm
just giving you guys the last word.
The thing about the immigration, it undermines everything else. And so whatever the issues, if it's around services, around, you know, domestic violence, or if it's around, like, how do you support someone to be part of a community, it's undermined. As soon as immigration is involved, you're just a statistic to be gotten rid of. And so I think this is why it's... Anyway... It is such a huge fight, but I totally agree that there's a lot more campaigns and things around prison reform, and we should be linking it. It's used like an additional prison, though. People have been in prison and then moved to detention centre and serve as long in detention centre for the different purpose. So the whole idea around that reform, it's just out the window, all that ideas about rehabilitation, because if you're coming out of prison, you're going to be part of the community again. If you're in detention, even though you may well come out into the community again, you're treated as if you simply don't count, and what happens to you or what you go through when you come out is of no importance. But I totally agree about linking the things and about keeping up momentum. Sorry, I feel like I'm trying to rush and I'm not going to do a good, clear answer, but I think that we consider victories, even where they've had to change or reduce detention a bit, it is a victory. It's not like the last thing we're going to win, but it's a victory because it proves to people that you can win victories, and because we need to see that optimism to keep fighting and to build that movement more. With Exeter, I'd love to come up to Exeter. I'm pretty sure there are people, because there's people from all over the place that have been. So I don't think that it's not possible that anyone in Exeter would see themselves protesting and banging fences at a detention centre.
I'd say there won't be Exeter at the Altamira.
Cool. there's gonna be, but hopefully the impact it's had on people has meant people going back to different places and speaking about it more, and that I think is the knock-on effect that should leak into the rest of consciousness in those different areas. Plus, the Home Office have a tendency to disperse people everywhere. And so that can either mean that you end up dispersed and isolated, or you're dispersed and you spread that movement. If you're part of a movement and you have that consciousness and you have that organising, then it can be a matter that you end up spreading that fight further. You have to have the confidence, you have to have some political perspective for it. That's what we're aiming to do. And even Safara Field, I think the most, I don't know, Middlesbrough has a particular, Middlesbrough and Teesside generally, like, has particularly depressed area that's really been gutted in terms of industry. I think Redcar's gone through losing thousands of jobs even just last year, and they dispersed a lot of asylum seekers there, and you know, people are moving out rather than moving into their empty houses. So I suppose it, the landlords can make some money by letting out through the Home Office, but it means that people are very much dumped, and it's been a tremendous lot of racist attacks and harassment and so on. There's no place that we can't have to come up with a way to build a movement. There's no place, there's no excuse anywhere, because otherwise we would just be saying that people are just racist, but people have been sold a certain idea. That doesn't mean people can't change.
I'm just saying that it's the people living, there's a lot of people like me who are more likely to want to support who are not ready to man the barricades, that's what
I say. There was a question also about the response from officers inside detention after demonstrations. Maybe things were worse after the demonstration.
After the demonstration, that was when, you know, you have been from the house after they had cancelled the demonstration. The next man, they released me. But the way the officers were in their task was, you know, they were not, I don't know how I can explain. It was not good. Let me say that it was not good. Because this side, so where I was in that, where Movement for Justice and other groups were facing these people. So when we were inside, the officers were lining up in the corridors. Mm-hmm. In the corridor. Maybe they were thinking that we were going to do something there, shouting, breaking windows and whatever. Mm-hmm. That is where they were. They were looking good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But like the idea that we had to. How was the atmosphere for the detainees?
The atmosphere was, because for me, when people like different groups maybe came for demonstration, I said that on that very day you are going to release that so that you can go out, but why have them like that? So we are there, so we kept quiet, but we had a feeling that one day we go out. So we had to move to do more sittings. So you're talking about it, and to say and to tell our people that if I'm out before you, please, you have to fight. Because if I go out, I will fight for you. If you go out before me, you will fight for me.
Thank you. On that note, we all need love. So I would just like to say two things before we go. First of all, there's a meeting. For those of you who are Oxford-based, you might be interested in a meeting on Wednesday evening at the Town Hall. It's a public meeting on immigration detention, and there's a fantastic lineup of speakers for that. So please take one of these, publicise it to as much as you can if you're based in Oxford. And then just to say thank you so much for the speakers for giving up this weekend and for these really kind of interesting, stimulating and contributions, and particularly to Jane for coming on the birthday.
Thank you.